Hi, this is the November 2024 edition of Junior Scholastic Magazine. I'm Chris Radio volunteer Kathy Danaher. On the cover of this month's issue is a large group photo of different middle school students, and the topic they will be considering for election 2024 is, What if you were president? Junior Scholastic asked 100 middle school students across the country for their opinions. Find out what they would change and why. Let's turn the page, and we begin first with an article in Geography called An Undersea Mystery. Off the coast of a remote Japanese island, an unusual rock formation rests deep beneath the waves. Where did it come from? For years, Japan's tiny Yanagugi Island, off the coast of a remote Japanese island, an unusual rock formation rests deep beneath the waves. Where did it come from? For years, Japan's tiny Yanagugi Island had just one claim to fame. Its waters were the perfect place for scuba divers to swim with hammerhead sharks. Then, in 1986, a local diver made a discovery that really put the island on the map. About 80 feet below the surface, he encountered a massive pyramid-like object. Now known as the Yanagugi Monument, the mysterious rock structure in the Pacific Ocean instantly sparked a debate. Had it been created by humans or by natural causes? Some observers point to what appear to be arched entrances and carved steps as evidence that it was constructed by ancient humans. The prehistoric Yamon people lived in the region as early as 16,000 years ago. But others say the structure was likely shaped by ocean currents, earthquakes, and other natural forces over millions of years. They note that the site resembles other natural geological formations with sharp corners and straight lines. For example, the Giant's Causeway in Ireland is made up of thousands of interlocking rock pillars. The pillars were formed by an ancient volcanic eruption. The Yanagugi debate continues, but research by geologists, archaeologists, and other experts tends to support the natural formation side. Are they right? Only hammerhead sharks may know for sure. The photo on pages 2 and 3 show the Yanagugi Monument and a diver walking along the flat steps of the rock structure nearly 80 feet below the surface. Next on page 4, under U.S. and World News, under the topic of civics, what does it take to pull off an election? A lot of poll workers. Learn how teens are stepping up to help on November 5th. Some schools may be closed this election day, but many teens across the country will still be hard at work, assisting voters at polling sites. States including California, Maine, and Pennsylvania are recruiting high school and college students to serve as poll workers, people hired to staff election sites. Poll workers do everything from checking in voters to answering questions. What's behind the push to hire young people to help Americans cast ballots? This month's election could require up to 1 million poll workers nationwide, according to the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. But in recent years, officials in many regions have reported difficulty hiring enough of them. One reason for the shortage is that poll workers tend to be older Americans. The average poll worker is 61, and many of them are starting to step away from the job. Election officials say there are benefits to having young poll workers. They may have an easier time moving heavy equipment than older workers and can use their tech savvy to reboot voting machines. For teens, too. Some young workers get free pizza on the job, and the work also looks great on college applications. But the biggest benefit, election officials say, is that it helps ensure election sites have enough staff to give all voters the chance to cast ballots on election day. According to statistics, 158.4 million people voted in the 2020 election. Some experts predict this year's turnout could be just as high. 94,000 polling sites across the United States will need to be staffed for the 2024 election. The article at the top of page 5 under the heading Environment is Too Much Ramen. Forget overcrowding and vandalism. A national park in South Korea is facing a very different challenge. A lot of ramen. The instant noodles are a popular food in South Korea. Many visitors pack them for lunch or a snack while they explore Mount Hala in Hallasan National Park. But they often dump their leftover broth on the ground and in streams, up to 31 gallons of it a day. That's a problem, local authorities say. The broth contains a lot of salt, which can harm endangered plant species on the mountains and wildlife in its streams. Plus, the broth scent attracts pests such as crows and weasels. After noodling over the issue, park officials have come up with a plan to help solve it. For starters, they've posted signs encouraging visitors to bring along just half a serving of ramen. And for those who end up with leftover broth anyway, officials are now providing designated places for them to discard it, large containers set along the trail. On the top right of the article is a photo of a bowl of ramen and a picture of Mount Hala, South Korea's tallest mountain. The second article on page 5 is under the heading of U.S. History, and it's titled A Revolutionary Find. Beneath the drawing of colonists holding their muskets and ready to go into battle is a photo of an actual musket ball that was likely fired from one of their guns nearly 250 years ago. The lead ball below, in the picture, may not look exciting, but experts suspect it was used in one of the most famous battles of the American Revolution, from 1775 to 1783. Researchers say it is a musket ball that was fired by colonists at the start of the war. Musket balls are ammunition shot from a musket, a gun that was common at the time. This one and four other musket balls were found last year near Concord, Massachusetts, at the site of the Battle of Concord. Colonists shot at British troops there and in nearby Lexington, Massachusetts, on April 19, 1775, sparking the revolution. The musket balls range from pea-sized to marble-sized. Researchers have determined that they were fired rather than dropped. Historic weapons expert Jared Foss was there the day the artifacts were found. "It's incredible. We can hold what amounts to just a few seconds of history that changed the world," he says. On page 6, under Geography and U.S. News, the article is titled, Shaky Ground. A new study shows that most of the United States could experience earthquakes within the next century. Find out what cities and states are doing to keep people safe. The photo on pages 6 and 7 shows an aerial view of a road that was torn apart by a 7.1 magnitude earthquake when it hit southern Alaska in 2018. It seemed like an ordinary spring morning, until it wasn't. An earthquake struck without warning near White House Station, New Jersey. It shook the ground through the northeastern United States, all the way from Boston, Massachusetts to Washington, D.C. The tremors could be felt by more than 42 million people. Even New York's Statue of Liberty swayed from the trembling. That 4.8 magnitude quake this past April was the strongest earthquake to hit New Jersey in 140 years. And experts say there may be more to come. According to a recent U.S. government report, about 75% of the country could experience dangerous shaking from earthquakes over the next century. Most earthquakes are so mild that they're not even felt. The New Jersey quake did not cause serious damage. But more powerful earthquakes can collapse buildings, spark fires, and even trigger landslides or flooding. If we don't prepare for earthquakes, they can cause problems, says Mark Peterson of the U.S. Geological Society. He is the lead scientist on the recent report, which pinpointed where earthquakes can happen and how much damage they're likely to cause. His goal is to help architects, engineers, and city planners identify where to make buildings safer. Earthquakes begin underground, in Earth's crust. The crust is made up of giant, slow-moving slabs of rock called tectonic plates. The plates sometimes collide, pull apart, or slide past each other. That can make the ground above them move and shake. Earthquakes can also occur along old cracks within a tectonic plate. The earthquake-prone spaces between and within plates are called faults. Many known faults lie along the Pacific coast, which is why California and Alaska experience more earthquakes than the rest of the country. Southern California has about 10,000 quakes a year, but only a fraction of them are noticeable. Scientists say other faults remain undetected, especially in the central and eastern U.S. Evidence of such faults has been removed by erosion from streams and long-ago glaciers, as well as human development. To determine where future earthquakes could strike, the United States Geological Survey researchers studied known faults. They also measured current ground movement where earthquakes have occurred. Finally, they analyzed where and when damaging earthquakes have taken place. What they found surprised them. Within the past 200 years, 37 states have experienced earthquakes that exceeded a magnitude of 5. That number represents a moderate quake, which could result in damage to buildings and other structures. Scientists also identified about 500 additional faults in the U.S. They found that California and Alaska are at even greater risk than previously thought. The risk in Hawaii is also higher than known before. The state is home to 5 active volcanoes. And their eruptions can trigger quakes. In addition, scientists learned more about roughly a dozen faults in the eastern U.S. The U.S. Geological Survey team created a map that forecasts where damaging quakes are most likely to occur. Local governments can use it to determine where precautions should be taken. For example, officials in high-risk areas can require that buildings be designed to sway rather than collapse during an earthquake. Engineers can also design bridges, roads, and dams strong enough to resist shaky ground. Some of that work is already underway. For example, California has been offering up to $3,000 to some residents to update older homes to be more earthquake resistant. And in many states, people participate in yearly earthquake drills to learn how to protect themselves if one strikes. Even with the new map, no one can predict when an earthquake will happen, Peterson says, but taking precautions can help communities stay safe and recover when the next one hits. A map of the United States on the bottom of page 8 shows which areas of the country are likely to experience earthquakes in the next 100 years. On page 9, the article is titled, "What If You Were President?" This month, Americans are picking their next leader. How can you help shape the country's future? You may not be old enough to vote yet, but your voice and your ideas matter. That's why, in this presidential election year, the editors of Junior Scholastic decided that we wanted to hear from middle schoolers like you. We interviewed 100 students from across the country, 2 from each state. We asked questions like, What are the most important qualities in a leader? And what is the first big thing you would do if you were president? Turn the page for the responses, then keep reading as we lead you through the basics of the upcoming election. Our guide offers facts about the candidates and a step-by-step view of how the Electoral College works. There's also a map pointing out other key races across the country. The information will help you follow along as America elects the country's 47th president. And it will offer you an opportunity, the chance to think about the vision that you and your peers have for the future, and how you can help make it a reality. Who knows? Maybe your name will be on the ballot for president one day. The first question Junior Scholastic asked the middle school students was, "What is the first big thing you would do if you were president?" It might be tempting to order a massive hot fudge sundae from the White House chef and catch a double feature in your private movie theater, presidential perks. But the students we talked to had more serious plans for their first day in office. One of the most popular tasks? Protecting the environment. Liam Saguar, an eighth grader from Kentucky, would promote electric cars and eliminate the use of fossil fuels. Other students would prioritize finding ways to clean the air and water. "We only have one Earth, so we need to save that Earth," says Grant Kerner, a seventh grader from North Carolina. Many students said they would use their presidential power to ensure that everyone has a home and healthy food. Gavin Huang, a sixth grader from California, would start by building more houses and apartments. "Everybody should have a safe place where they can sleep at night or keep their belongings and not worry about them being stolen," he says. Sonika Von Carew, a sixth grader from Pennsylvania, agrees. "I would give every homeless person a house and good-paying job," she says. High prices were another hot topic. Many students said they would use their role to tackle inflation, a rise in prices over time that can make goods or services costlier. "It makes life hard when everything's so expensive," explains Abby Metconis, a seventh grader from Maryland. Clementine Ferrara, a seventh grader from Wisconsin, agrees. "Some people can't afford food or clothes for their kids," she says. Clementine's solution? Raising the minimum wage, which is the lowest amount most workers can be paid hourly. The top 10 answers given by middle school students if they were president were protect the environment, help the homeless, lower food and gas prices, improve schools, treat people equally, create more jobs and raise pay, address immigration, lower health care costs, end war, and help stray dogs. When asked, "What are the most important qualities in a U.S. president?" the students answered, "The president has many jobs, including shaping U.S. policy and representing the country. So, what traits are essential?" "Kindness and honesty," the middle schooler said. One in five students singled out kindness. "A kind president would care about people and try to help them," explains Pravit Thakkar, a seventh grader from New Jersey. Just as many students brought up honesty. "We should be able to trust the president in what they say," says Caleb Jefferson, an eighth grader from South Carolina. When asked, "When you think about the future of the United States, what's most important to you?" This was another chance for students to share their hopes and concerns about the future. Protecting the environment and addressing homelessness once again topped the list. For some students, making sure kids get a good education is most important. It's an investment for the whole country's future, they point out. If you're handing off the country to the next generation, I feel like the next generation has to be well educated, says Josh Walker, a seventh grader from Texas. Other students hope all Americans feel secure in the future. What's most important is that everyone's safe, explains Emmalyn Mitchell, a seventh grader from Utah. The top 10 answers were the environment, homelessness, safety, education, inflation, treating people equally, affordable health care, uniting people, ending hunger, and ending war. The fourth question, what do you want the next president to know? The students we talked to said they would urge the president to focus on problems facing the U.S., including homelessness, inflation, the environment, and health care costs. Make sure everybody feels safe and protected, suggests Malin Collins, a sixth grader from Massachusetts. Others would offer advice on how the president should act, including listening to and respecting all Americans. People matter, says Tristan Smith, an eighth grader from Arizona. We should work together and not against each other. Telling the president to be fair was also a priority for some. I want all people to be treated equally, says Azariah Green, a seventh grader from Mississippi. When it comes down to it, the students agree. The next president should do their best. Go with your gut, says Reagan Rogers, a seventh grader from Florida. And, adds Kellen Halfast, a sixth grader from Indiana, keep kids in mind when you make decisions. On page 12, the election guide continues under How Does the Presidential Election Work? Here's what you need to know as the U.S. elects its next president. Step 1. Choosing electors. Democratic and Republican officials in each state appoint electors. These are people who hope to represent their state in the Electoral College, the body that officially determines the winner of the presidential election. Each set of electors pledges to support their party's presidential and vice presidential candidates. Step 2, the popular vote. Americans cast ballots through early voting, by mail, or in person on Election Day. This is called the popular vote. But even though the candidates' names are on the ballots, voters aren't directly choosing the president. Instead, their votes help determine which party's electors will represent their state in the Electoral College. Step 3, winning electors. Most states have a winner-takes-all rule. The candidate who wins the state's popular vote gets to have all their electors from that state participate in the Electoral College. Each state's number of electors is based on how many members it has in the Senate and House of Representatives. Every state has 2 senators. Representatives are based on state population. Step 4, the Electoral College vote. In December, electors meet, usually in their state capitals, to cast their official votes for president and vice president. To win, a candidate must receive votes from at least 270 electors, more than half of the 538 total possible votes. If a single candidate wins the popular vote in most states, this outcome is usually already known. Each state's votes are recorded and sent to the U.S. Congress. Step 5, declaring the winner. Members of the Senate and the House of Representatives meet on January 6 to officially count the electoral votes from each state. The process is largely ceremonial. The current vice president, who also serves as president of the Senate, formally announces the winner. And step 6, Inauguration Day. The president-elect is sworn into office by the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court on January 20th. During the ceremony, the new president takes the oath of office, swearing to protect and uphold the U.S. Constitution. Who's running for president this year? Kamala Harris. On the bottom of page 13 are photographs of the two individuals who are running for president this year in 2024. Kamala Harris represents the Democratic Party. She was elected U.S. Vice President in 2021 to the present. She's also a U.S. Senator from California who was there from 2017 to 2021. She was Attorney General of California from 2011 to 2017. Her profession? She is an attorney. And she was born on October 20th, 1964, from Oakland, California. Her running mate is Tim Walz, who's a governor of Minnesota. Donald J. Trump represents the Republican Party, and he was elected to the U.S. presidency from 2017 to 2021. His profession is that of a real estate developer and business person. His date of birth is June 14, 1946, and he was born in New York, New York. On page 14, under Cool Social Studies Careers, the article is titled Reframing History. A photographer by the name of Matika Wilbur is on a mission to change the way other people see Native Americans. Matika's picture appears on the top of page 14. Matika Wilbur has traveled hundreds of thousands of miles across the country. She's driven in her RV, Big Girl, she calls it. She's also traveled on foot and by train, plane, and boat. She even rode a horse to get through the Grand Canyon in Arizona. Why? To capture the world with her camera. Wilbur is a documentary photographer and photojournalist. Photojournalists tell stories through photography. Their images can record history, convey emotion, and inspire people. They can also change the way we see the world. Wilbur wants her photographs to change the way many people see Native Americans. She is a member of the Swinomish and Tulalip tribes in Washington State. She knows some Americans have false ideas about indigenous people, and she wants to challenge those stereotypes. There are stories the community needs you to tell, Wilbur says. She decided to photograph and interview members of 562 tribal nations in the United States. That was the number of tribes that were recognized by the U.S. government when she started the project in 2012. Today, there are 574. Wilbur's vibrant images depict both young and older Native Americans, often in places that are important to them. Some of the people wear traditional clothes. Others wear more modern outfits. They all look proud and strong, and they highlight the diversity of American people across the United States. The images are now in a book, Project 562, Changing the Way We See Native America. Each image is accompanied by a narrative that shares the traditions and experiences of the person in the photo. Here, Wilbur talks about her work and why it's important. What got you interested in photography? When I was young, maybe age 15, I heard a National Geographic photographer talking about one of her recent assignments where she had been to Tibet. Tibet is a region of China. I was really drawn to her stories of adventure. I thought, that's the kind of life I want to have. I want to be able to travel and tell stories and meet people. What made you decide to photograph Native American tribes? For far too long, Native American images have been very stereotypical. We've been misrepresented in Hollywood. We've been misrepresented in textbooks. I wanted to change that stereotype. How did you find people to photograph? Before I went to visit a tribe, I would post on social media and say, does anybody know anybody here? A lot of times that worked. Sometimes I still wouldn't know anybody when I got to a tribe. I'd pull up in my RV and put up a sign, free fry bread for a photo. Fry bread is a Native American flatbread that is fried until crispy on the outside but soft on the inside. People would invite me to their house or have me over for dinner. They'd say, you should photograph this elder. then that elder might say, "You have to photograph my niece." It went on like that everywhere I went. I would stay as long as I needed to get the shot. How did you prepare before a shoot? I interviewed people until they felt comfortable with me, which usually takes 2 or 3 hours. Sometimes it would take 2 days. I would stick around and do their dishes until we were friends. We would talk about identity, race, politics, their life story, and their children. I'd ask them about the things we all go through as human beings and what it means to be a Native person. What is the biggest challenge you face in your work? When people tell you their stories, they often share the difficult things that they have been through, including violence and forced assimilation. This is when people are made to adopt the beliefs, values, and behaviors of the majority, in this case, the non-Indigenous population. It was hard for me to hear those stories and to process my own anger about the Western structures causing those problems. Why is photojournalism important? Seeing is believing. A photograph can open a door for our imaginations to believe in something we haven't previously been able to believe in. So many social movements have happened because of photojournalism. Photos end wars. Photos drives compassion to support nonprofits that help people who are hungry or starving. Photos can shape the course of history. How does your work help people understand society? Everywhere in this country, there are sad stories about how Native Americans lost their land and identity. There's also a tremendous amount of inspiring stories in Indian country, stories of profound resilience and cultural resurrection. I hope that my work can help teach Native American values and the real history of our country. I hope it will inspire people to ask questions like, how can we be in better relationships with our Indigenous relatives? How can we take better care of the land? There was so much to learn from our Native American communities. How do you share your work? To promote Project 562, I've been in more than 200 schools. I've given away more than 15,000 books. I'm teaching educators how to use this book and overcome stereotypes in their classrooms. What do you like most about your job? I like the adventure of it. I want to be out in the world seeing new things. I want to be under the stars, listening to coyotes, eating traditional foods. There are so many great epic journeys left, and that's really why I'm a journalist. What advice do you have for kids and teens interested in photojournalism? Well, I hope they do it. We need storytellers. We need people to speak truth to power. So I would say, tell stories. Tell honest stories. Whatever you want to do, whoever you want to be, you can do it. On page 15 are several photos of Native Americans from different tribes, representing only a small sampling of the hundreds of tribal nations. On page 16, under a history connection, the information box is titled Overcoming Oppression. When Europeans began arriving in North America in the late 1400s, they seized vast areas of land, but millions of people belonging to hundreds of unique cultures were already living there. In the centuries that followed, Native Americans tried to hold on to their lands by negotiating treaties. Despite that, white settlers pushed west, backed by the U.S. Army. Many indigenous people died in the fighting. Millions of others were wiped out by the diseases introduced by the Europeans. By 1880, many tribes faced hunger and despair. Most Native Americans had been forced into government-controlled reservations. At the same time, thousands of indigenous children were sent away to boarding schools. Many of the children were abused. They were forced to stop speaking their languages and practicing their customs. Today, more than 9 million Native Americans from hundreds of diverse tribes live in the U.S. Many are actively working to reclaim the land and cultures that were stripped away from them. On page 18, under U.S. History, Remembering Vietnam. Millions of Americans served in the Vietnam War, one of the longest, costliest conflicts in U.S. history. First, learn about the war. Then read an eyewitness account from a veteran who took part. Whether they realize it or not, most Americans know someone who is a veteran, a parent or grandparent, an aunt, uncle, or cousin, a teacher or neighbor, or friend of a friend. It's not always easy to tell because they no longer wear a uniform, and their military service may have ended years ago. Not all veterans saw combat, but many did, including millions of Americans who took part in the Vietnam War. That lasted from 1954 to 1975. That conflict in Southeast Asia was one of the longest, costliest wars in U.S. history. In 2022, inspired by Junior Scholastic's Eyewitness to History contest, then 8th grader Hayden Bolitho took the time to talk with a Vietnam veteran he knew well. Hayden's uncle, Thomas Bolitho, fought in Operation Starlight. That historic mission was the first time American troops took part in on-the-ground fighting in Vietnam. The unrest started decades earlier. For more than a century, Vietnam had been a French colony. Then from 1946 to 1954, the Vietnamese people fought France for their independence and won. But who would rule? Communist leaders dominated northern Vietnam. Democratic ones led in the south. In 1954, an international agreement split the country in two until elections could determine a government for a united Vietnam. But those elections never happened. Instead, a new war broke out, this time between North Vietnam and South Vietnam. Other nations took sides, turning Vietnam into an international battleground. North Vietnam was supported by China, the Soviet Union, and other communist countries. South Vietnam was backed by the United States and other democratic countries. The U.S. feared that if South Vietnam lost the war, communism would spread to other parts of Southeast Asia. At first, the U.S. sent military advisors and supplies, but no combat troops. That changed in 1964, after North Vietnamese forces attacked two U.S. warships. The U.S. responded by bombing North Vietnam, and in August 1965, launching Operation Starlight. The mission involved landing 5,000 Marines in South Vietnam to surround some enemy troops. The operation was successful, but the war would drag on for another decade, with about 58,000 U.S. troops losing their lives. In 1975, North Vietnam won the war. The photo on page 19 is a picture of U.S. troops who were fighting in Vietnam in 1966. They are seen walking across a muddy road after a battle, looking tired, carrying their guns, ammunition, and field equipment. About 2.7 million Americans served in the Vietnam War. What was fighting in the war like? To find out, read Thomas Bolitho's first-person account on page 20. Under Eyewitness to History, it is entitled A Marine Story by Hayden Bolitho. My uncle, Thomas Bolitho, was a member of the U.S. Marine Corps and took part in Operation Starlight, the first major battle for American forces in the Vietnam War. It took place over 8 days in 1965, from August 17th to August 24th. I chose to interview my uncle because he is so proud to be a Marine. I wanted to find out why he felt that way. How old were you when you joined the Marines? I was 22. My first training was boot camp at Parris Island, South Carolina, for 13 weeks. That was followed by 9 months of training in North Carolina, California, Japan, Thailand, and the Philippines. I was part of Lima Company, a 3rd Battalion and 3rd Marine Regiment. How did you travel to Vietnam? By boat from the Philippines. Some Marine units, including mine, went ashore on a beach near Da Nang in South Vietnam. Others were airlifted by helicopter to 3 landing zones on the other side of Viet Cong forces. The Viet Cong were a military group that fought alongside the North Vietnamese Army. Were you notified by officials that you were going to war? Nope. While we were on the boat, we were given flak jackets, a type of body armor, hand grenades, and weapons. That made us realize we were going to war. Where did you land and why? We landed at a place called Green Beach. Our commander had realized that an airbase near Chu Lao could be a threat. Seeing an opportunity to destroy an important enemy unit, he set in motion a major operation, a surprise attack. Our mission on Green Beach was to overwhelm the enemy and force them west and north. This tactic was called the Hammer and Anvil. The goal was to squeeze the enemy between 2 of our battalions. Our battalions would meet in the middle, destroying them. What was that like for you? I'd never been in a war before. I found out what it was really about as soon as we docked on Green Beach. My battalion had a mix of new and experienced Marines, but most of us had never witnessed a large-scale battle or suffered through the terror of a jungle ambush. I was inexperienced, but I learned on the go. I overcame the original shock and fought like a Marine. The Viet Cong and North Vietnamese Army discovered that we were skilled and well-trained. The enemy radio station called us Paper Tiger soldiers at the start of the mission because they considered us inexperienced. But as the war progressed, they just called us tigers. How was the enemy you faced? They were very experienced in war because by that point they had been fighting the French army for almost 10 years, and they were also very familiar with the local terrain. What were some enemy tactics? The Viet Cong would hide in camouflaged holes called spider holes. After we passed by, they would jump out of the holes and attack our forces from behind. That slowed our advance. Also, after a battle, the Viet Cong would pretend to be dead. As we passed through them, they would rise and throw grenades at us. Our captain was killed that way. I lost a lot of friends in that war. One goal of the operation was to take over the village of Nam Yen. Did you succeed? No. We were attacked from 4 directions and surrounded by enemy forces. We tried to fight our way out, but we were being overrun. Once we realized we weren't going to take over Nam Yen, we returned to an area called Zone Blue. We stayed there in a defensive position. In the morning, tanks arrived and helped us get out of there. Even though we did not take over the village, the overall operation was a success. What does it mean to you to be a Marine? Semper Fidelis, Latin for always faithful. That's the Marine Corps motto. It symbolizes the Marine's lifelong commitment of brotherhood. Always be faithful, always be there for each other. Hayden's conclusion. I have learned from this project how important the U.S. Marine Corps is to our country. Marines are sent into the toughest battles. They are relied upon to keep our country free. I believe they are the best fighting force in the world. On the top of page 20 is a picture of Hayden Bolitho, age 16, of South Park, Pennsylvania, with his uncle, veteran Thomas Bolitho, who gave all the information to Junior Scholastic about the Vietnam War. On the bottom of page 21 to the left is a map of Vietnam, and the title of the map is The Former Battleground. Now at peace, Vietnam was ravaged by war for nearly three decades. On page 22, under the Junior Scholastic heading of Debate, the title is Should the U.S. Build a Colony on the Moon? A bubble-shaped living quarter, people riding in moon buggies, astronauts bouncing high in the air with every step. The idea of humans living on the moon has long been the stuff of science fiction, but some experts think those dreams could soon become reality. NASA, the U.S. space agency, plans to land astronauts on the lunar surface in 2026. The goal is to establish a permanent colony. The colony would be a base camp and training area for future trips to Mars. For many Americans, the achievement would fulfill a long-held dream. From 1969 to 1972, NASA landed 12 astronauts on the lunar surface, but the longest stay was just shy of 75 hours, and no human has been there since. Supporters of a lunar settlement say having people live on the moon could lead to scientific advancements that benefit all humankind. Critics, however, argue that money invested in the mission would be better spent fixing urgent problems on Earth. Should the U.S. build a colony on the moon? Two experts who work in the space industry weigh in. In the yes column, living on the moon would promote knowledge and scientific advancement. The moon is our first stepping stone to the rest of the universe. Building a human settlement there would be an immense scientific and technological advancement. A lunar colony would let us learn more about how Earth and the moon formed. It would give us access to natural resources, such as iron, that are useful on Earth and in space exploration. And it would bring about valuable innovations, such as new ways of making clean air and water. There would be political benefits, too. Space exploration is a great way to promote international cooperation. For many years, Russia and Western nations have worked together on the International Space Station, despite their conflicts on Earth. The same could happen in a lunar colony. Plus, whichever nation settles on the moon first will set expectations about behavior in space. An unfriendly nation could claim lunar territory or use greedy and destructive mining practices to access natural resources there. We want a friendly country to be the first to settle the moon. So why not us? Building a space settlement will be incredibly challenging. But as President John F. Kennedy, who pushed the U.S. space program forward in the 1960s, once said, "We choose to do some things not because they are easy, but because they are hard." A moon settlement is a challenge worthy of our effort. And in the no settlement column, the money would be better spent helping people and fixing problems on Earth. NASA aims to establish a permanent presence on the moon for the benefit of humanity, but it isn't clear what those benefits might be. The idea of building colonies on other planets has been talked about for decades. However, the number of Americans who actually support such efforts is much smaller than you might think. In 2023, the Pew Research Center asked people to rank 9 priorities for NASA in order of importance. Sending humans to the moon and to Mars came last, in 8th and 9th place. One of the highest priorities, getting a grip on climate change. Warmer average global temperatures, rising sea levels, and more extreme weather events aren't the only major challenges we face on Earth. Think about hunger, disease, and wars. Humans should address the problems on Earth before they begin living in space. Money focused on helping Earth would benefit more people than money spent colonizing the moon. NASA has already poured $30 billion into the Moon Colony Program. And by 2025, The overall investment is expected to reach $93 billion. Americans are footing the bill through the taxes they pay. Private companies that work with NASA, such as Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and SpaceX, will make a lot of money. But how will this public investment benefit taxpayers, let alone all of humanity? And that's all for this installment of Junior Scholastic Magazine. I'm Chris Volunteer, Kathy Danaher. So long, until next month.